My mind was blown. At the high school where Peter Parker went to, there were black students going. And he spoke to one of them. The guy said, how's it going today? Fine. Oh, that was enough for me. You can stop talking now. I like that idea that it wasn't like a special thing. Oh, we're going to go to a black school today. He was a part of an integrated school. And you can't imagine what that was like in the early 1960s to see.
All right, so welcome again to the Comic Book Historians Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Professor William Foster III, a historian in comics that specializes in African-American representation in comics. I'm Alex Grand with my co-host, Jim Thompson. Jim?
Hi, everybody.
Professor Foster, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, this is my absolute pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen, for extending the invitation.
So we're going to start with kind of like your early involvement in comics. Jim's going to start off with that. Then we're going to talk about your book that I really enjoyed very much, that we both enjoyed very much, Looking for a Face Like Mine, which is a different articles of black representation in comics, which I found really moving and just a really great history. Jim, go ahead and start with it.
Okay. So Professor Foster, where are you from?
Originally Philadelphia.
And where did you move to?
Oh, dude, how much time you got? I went to school in Massachusetts and then moved to Connecticut. When I moved to Connecticut, I was working for a weekly reader of all places. It doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but it was a lot of fun. And that's where I am now in Connecticut. I love here.
Oh, okay. All right. So no other parts of the country, never lived in the South or anything like that?
No, Detroit for a minute. And that was a blessing. I'm sorry. That's wrong. But no, I got to tell you, I love New England, man. It really has a lore of its own.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I'm from Virginia originally, so I'm a Southerner. But
that's where my dad's from.
Oh, how about that? We're in Richmond.
Richmond? that's the only family story I got.
Okay. No, because which side of the river makes a great difference.
Doesn't it always? Isn't that true in every city?
I lived in Detroit for a year, but I was in Boston for a year. And you're right. There is something about that New England vibe. I do love it, too. It's multicultural. It's really interesting.
I'm telling you. And it's part of that New England, that Northeastern brain trust that goes on in our country. I love that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your entry to comics. When did you start reading? What books or lines were you interested in? That kind of information.
Oh, no problem at all. I started when I was about 11 reading comics, but I was a voracious reader. I read, that old insult you'd give somebody, go read an encyclopedia. That was me. I was the guy reading the encyclopedia. I couldn't get enough. And comic books were just great. I mean, they told a story vividly and in bright colors. Superman and Batman were my two favorite characters. For the comics I could afford, and I was lucky. I had a couple of buddies who were twin brothers, and their parents were a little higher financial scale. So they bought them all the new comics as soon as they came out. And I would come over, they'd let me read them. I said, hey, you guys are all right. I don't care what anybody else says about you.
Now, what era of Superman and Batman are you reading? Because I don't know your age.
Silver Age. I was like the early 60s, and Kurt Swan is my favorite Superman artist.
So what's the year of your birth then?
1953.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of the approximate year of birth of a lot of our guests, it seems, is early 50s, yeah.
It was free and cheap entertainment, and before you got to the era where everybody told us we're going to die and go to hell if we read comics, it was a great time. Actually, it got better after people said that, because now we really wanted to read them,
So you were reading Kurt Swan drawing Superman, and probably you were around during the new look Batman around the time of the show. So Infantino's new look.
Absolutely. But, the Batman annuals were reprinting stories from the 50s before I was old enough to read them. Man, I ate those up because Batman was just more dynamic. I mean, you couldn't cross a roof without having a giant toothbrush or, a razor or something. It was great.
I love those giant annuals on all man. Of that. So now, did you just limit yourself to those two characters at that point, or did you step into Justice League and The Flash and all those other characters?
Every Superman title I pretty much read, including Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen. World's Finest, of course, was obviously combining my two heroes, so I love that one. But my parents cleverly got me into Classics Illustrated.
Ah.
And then my cousins read all the Harvey comic books, Hot Stuff, Spooky, Then I called some, my sisters of the Archies. Yeah, my sisters. It wasn't me. Never me. But I, you know, so I had a real wide range of comic books I was looking at. Even some Charlton comics occasionally would, you know, would drop by off my way. Some old EC, my dad brought home a box of those one time, had a real heavy mildew smell, like I cared.
And, oh, that's great.
I just went through those, man.
So which one? The horror books or the science fiction?
Yeah. Oh, all of them.
All of them?
Had a nice selection. I used to love the fact that this was something that the critics of comic books never got. That you only something bad would happen to you only if you weren't a good person. If you were an evil person or you had an evil plan or you kill somebody for their money or you kill somebody's husband so you go out with their wife, you know it was coming for you. And that's the part us kids were looking for, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. EC was really good about that, too. That if you were cheating on your girlfriend, you were probably going to end up with your head taken off and used as a bowling ball.
Yeah. Or served up to somebody, you know, with the eyeball still in it.
Yeah. And don't sell tainted meat because you're going to get it.
Tainted meat. That's so true.
All right. So it's interesting. You haven't mentioned Marvel. Yeah. When Marvel came out,
I was hooked. But before that, I was big DC fan or a lot of different publishers. But when they brought out Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, those were two I kind of read. Doctor Strange, I loved.
Oh, yeah.
And then as they moved into more titles, Captain America was okay. I liked him. You know, Thor, not so much. Iron Man, okay. You know, but Spider-Man primarily because, first of all, as history tells us, he was the first teenage superhero, if you don't count Superboy and, you know, and Robin. You know, they were sidekicks. Spider-Man was on his own right. And he had a real complex life.
Now, what was your thinking about, now, with the EC comics, they actually dealt with race, especially in the shock suspense stories and things. But in others, too, they actually acknowledged that there were other people. Not so much with the comics that you're talking about.
It's true. That was funny. In DC comics, as I got older and I started looking at the images over and over again, I noticed that the only time they'd have a black person in a DC comics was when they were at the UN. And then they weren't African Americans, they were Africans.
Yeah. Had the whole iconographic images of it.
Yeah, the outfit.
But ironically, they used to do a bunch of public service announcements in the books. And there you could see people of color. Of course, they were in poor countries being served food or building schools and stuff like that. But that was pretty much it for the longest time.
Yeah, you know? Jack Schiff was putting out a lot of those ads in DC Comics.
I did a piece on those at the Popular Culture Association, a national convention, and I just had the time of my life because I had all these examples. And people who had never seen them didn't know pretty much what I was talking about, but they had some good advice, you know, be a good citizen, you know, be open to other cultures. That was good, but that was the only time you saw it. In fact, I read a Superboy comic where Superboy goes to Africa and every stereotype's in play, but in the first two pages of the book, they have this, you know, this ad talking about we're all brothers. So I said, I see that right now, the brothers thing.
Now, did you... When there were, I mean, some of the genres, even in the DC comics and the Marvel comics, allowed for black representation. I'm thinking of Gabe Jones in the Howling Commandos and Sergeant Rock. You know, there was one black
Gravedigger. Gravedigger.
Yeah. Well, and there was Gravedigger, too. You know, so you had some of that stuff. Did you seek those books out? Were you happy or pleased to see black representation, or did it matter?
I noticed that it was missing, but it didn't necessarily detract from the story. I mean, but it's funny you should mention that because the non-superhero characters I saw that were people of color were in Marvel. Peter Parker's high school had a black kid in it.
Yeah, Peter Parker's and Robertson.
Yep.
I mean, they had a real job.
Had a black cop, you know, like you see there at any point in time, you know, and it wasn't like, oh, well, you have to wait till some Negroes come along so you can arrest them. I mean, he was doing his job. And that was kind of stuck out in Marvel, you know.
Yeah, it seemed like Stanley was more progressive than Carmine Infantino when it came to stuff like that.
I met Neil Adams at a show. I brought my entire collection of comic books and different stuff to in New York. And I didn't know who he was, but he introduced himself to me and his son. And he said he was standing in the one of the editor's office, and it was like they were asking for a new Green Lantern. And they were talking about him doing another blonde guy. And he said, I got sick of this. So I said, listen, do me a favor. Come with me over to the window. We're in New York City. Look out there. What do you see? You see people of every ethnicity. Why are we only representing one? I said, look, man, you got to help us out. You know, we have to represent what the reality is. That's what comic books have the opportunity of doing. And he said that's how he got Stewart as a Black Green Lantern.
Yeah, John Stewart. Yeah. He's a great character.
Oh, yeah, man. Still to this day.
That run, for me, changed probably growing up as a Southerner. I was 11 or 12 when that first Green Lantern, Green Arrow, with the, you done a heap for the orange skins and the purple skins. That was a defining moment for me. I always list that as one of the things that changed my life in terms of it woke me up in a real way.
I like the cover where they show John Stewart without a Green Lantern mask.
Yeah.
And when Hal Jordan asked him, well, why aren't you wearing a mask? He said, look at me, dude. You think nobody's going to know I'm Black? Put a mask on. No, I'm not doing that. Get out of here. And he just had some, you know, he had some bite to him. He had some, you know, some flavor. Because let's face it, Hal Jordan was kind of like a, you know, a tight ass.
Oh, totally. And they got that. Denny O'Neill understood that. And that's what he did with the character was, I mean, Green Arrow would say you're a tight ass, basically. In the Avengers, when Professor Bill Foster actually appears in the comics.
1967. Never forget it.
Were you there? So you read that? Because I remember that issue. Because that was a standout too, that's a scientist. And it wasn't like just a one-issue appearance. He became, you know, not a significant part of the Marvel Universe until later when he, gains powers. But he was a character and a recurring character.
Yeah, I was more people. Actually, people kind of hit me to that because I didn't really notice that until later. And I started looking back when he became Black Goliath. That's when I kind of got it because they had the introduction right over the top of the page, you know, the first page of every book, all five issues. And I just went back in time to see who he was and where he was. And it turned out he's the guy that Henry Pym asked about, you know, how can I get this? I'm having difficulty with this controlling my size thing. And I said, whoa, that's just outrageous. That's great. You know.
And they introduce him, and then they bring in the Sons of the Serpents, you know, and it really is. Marvel's doing stuff that's very different from any of the other companies.
And then got the Black Panther coming out in 1966, which is like, whoa, you know, where were we in America in 1966?
Now, were you reading that in real time, or did something you discovered after?
They introduced him in the Fantastic Four. How was I not going to read him? It was great.
All right. So that must have been really something.
And it was funny is that even then, there were people who had never picked up a comic book were absolutely convinced that Stan Lee was naming him after the Black Panthers political party. It's close if you look at the timelines for both, but no, there was no way that was a crossover. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think technically, time-wise, he may have done that 3 months before.
Yep.
The political group. So
yep.
I think it was almost like a coincidence because there's a delay in printing by the time it got out anyway.
But I think there was a reference to the party in a newspaper or magazine that may predate it. I've argued with Arlen Schumer about this before, and that was fun.
But it's funny. You know how can I include you guys in the group, the Geek Boys? You know, they don't like coincidences. They don't, you know, so that's okay. But no, I don't think so. But it was like amazing when he took the Fantastic Four to Wakanda and they're super scientific and the spear is not a spear, it's a ray gun, you know, and they have, you know, they have rituals and a fine tradition. And it was just like, what a time, you know, they couldn't have timed it better.
Yeah.
So back to your history, just because we could get lost in the comics, and we're going to for the next hour or so. But let's talk about, so educationally speaking, so you're reading comics. Do you put it aside and move on to science fiction or some other thing, or do you stay in comics and continue reading that? And what happens in terms of, do you decide you want to be a professor? Do you decide you want to write? Do you ever want to work in comics? Tell us about that next stage now that you're like a little bit older.
Oh, no problem. I was a voracious reader, like I said, and science fiction was a major genre. I mean, I went through my school's library like a wildfire. Heinlein was one of my favorite, Norse, Norton, Samuel Delaney. I read all of those guys. I loved their work. And comic books were taking me that same way, you know, give me a world of fantasy, but it helped me in science class, if you can believe it or not.
Sure.
Junior high school science class. One day my science instructor says, okay, I'm going to give you guys a property of a metal. You tell me what metal it is. Who's the only guy in class, thanks to reading the Metal Men, that knew every metal and got the answer right?
Oh, yeah.
But at the same token, I still had people, not my parents, people. I was a big church-going family, so you could always have somebody with an opinion and didn't know how to shut up. were telling me that comic books were going to rot my brain. It was like, oh, this is a waste of time. Don't read those funny books, you know. And I just said nothing. But I say a bunch now because I'm thinking, yeah, you're right. They're not going to take me anywhere except to Germany, China, Australia, Britain. Yeah, I didn't go nowhere. I should put those comic books down. I wasted my life. But yeah, so I was a simultaneous reader. Like I said, I couldn't not read. Once I picked up stuff and found out I could be through the opening of a book, I could go into another world. That was it for me. You know, I even tried reading novels from other eras and novels not necessarily written for boys. I was a big Nancy Drew fan. See if I could figure out the mystery before anybody else in the room.
Nice.
Then I come to find out the books I was reading was like, what, they were 20 years old, you know, and they're still producing Nancy Drew.
Were there any genres that you just thought, you know, I just can't handle this because it's just too damn white. There's no reference to my... I'm thinking of fantasy especially. I mean, Tolkien is awfully white, you know, and all of that. And I love it, but there is no space. Whereas with science fiction, even if it's by metaphor, it slips in all the time. And I don't think it does in fantasy nearly as much.
No, it didn't. It's interesting. I don't, my awareness of people who looked like me in books was kind of like, it was kind of dulled for a long time. I think maybe towards my last part. Oh, I know what, actually. You asked me what genres I read. This is about the time, late 60s, early 70s, when Zap comics came out.
Yeah.
And they didn't care who you were. Everybody gets made fun of. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And I got to tell you, I just said, whoa. And I read a book that featured Richard Grasshopper Green. And I said, this guy must be black because he's just too damn funny.
Yeah.
A lot of people were afraid to talk about race. And he talked about it up front, you know.
So when you're reading, and you'd see these images from people like Robert Crumb, you were good with that.
I know some people who, like, if you said good morning, they would say, what do you mean by that? That wasn't me. The idea is I had a sense that he understood. He ironically grew up in Philadelphia, so, you know, or just outside. And I'm looking at somebody, and I just get a sense where somebody's trying to be hurtful in what they're saying or not. And I never felt like that. He was being funny. And I could stop laughing until I stopped choking. Then I could, you know, like, oh, yeah, that's offensive. No, it wasn't, you know. But I met some people who just, like, everything's offensive. Then yeah. I can't help you because that's not how I roll.
And that's all something right. You mentioned in the book is that because there's some of the younger people that look at him as a bad person. You analyzed him in your book as saying, well, he offended everybody equally and that it was because of that. You appreciated kind of where he was coming from in that sense and that you feel that you don't feel like he should be canceled in some way over the stuff he's done. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a bit much. I think that we had people who were censoring comic books. We had people who were having comic book burnings. God, that was an awful image. What country did that take us back to?
Yeah.
And I didn't feel that was necessary at all. You don't like, And there were all kinds of comic books. There were religious comic books, and I read those because I came from a very religious family. I loved the books that were written about the life of Jesus or the great prophets. So I had a full-rounded education in terms of things that I could reach for. It wasn't like comic books were evil and death, you know, besides the fact that the comic books of the 60s and 50s were kind of mild. The idea is that you never really saw anybody kill anybody unless it was an imaginary story,
right?
You know. Lex Luthor was a bad guy, but he only killed Superman in an imaginary story. You know, nowadays, who knows what could happen? You
right.
know? That's when the comic book code was in place. But no, I never came after guys, particularly since I met guys later on, and I'm very fortunate, like Larry Fuller and Richard Gasparini. Again, I met them in person, and they're talking about what they did those days, and they just laugh, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's cool.
So I want to get you into college. Tell us about your educate. Like, what did you decide? What did you want to do as a career? And then how did you go about it?
It's funny. I started writing very young. I didn't start writing well until I got to college. I started writing for the school newspaper. I wrote for the literary magazine. I wrote for the news service editorial. It was an explosion for me. I had been writing stories since I was young because I was inspired by the books I was reading. So when I got to college, mass communication journalism was a straightforward run for me. I knew exactly. I had friends who didn't know what the heck they were going to do in college. But my parents, you know, college was serious. If you're going to go to college, you better have something to do. And so I took it very serious, you know. And I met all kinds of people there as well. So if you want to, and in fact, one of the guys who became the founder of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles went to UMass the same time I was there.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, oh. Man.
Which one?
The fat guy with the glasses.
Oh, that's probably Laird.
The one that married the really attractive woman, and everybody's saying, what the hell happened there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then Kevin Eastman married Julia Strain and all that, yeah.
Hey, dude, life is full of mysteries. And the thing about Connecticut is something I didn't mention that I didn't realize when I moved here is that a lot of cartoonists and comic writers live here. You know, once they made it big, they out of New York they came, you know, right up the road to Connecticut and just took the commuter train down there. So that worked out really well for me to meeting people.
When did you do something related to comics on a professional level?
Oh, interesting. I think I must have started writing about them in college because I had this interest. I just didn't have. Okay, I got to tell you a story you've heard more than one time. My parents threw my comic books out after I moved out.
Oh, yeah.
I've forgiven them now, thanks to the therapy. But I had to start my collection all over again, so I'm starting in a brand new era, you know. And I had, no, please don't get me started on what I had. I'll just tell you where I went from there, because that'll be a long story by itself. But no, I just started reading everything again. And like you said, there was a new flavor in comics for, you know, DC was trying to get with it. Marvel was just going, you know, they had women superheroes, you know.
And now you're talking the 1970s, right?
Absolutely, bro.
Yeah.
So I graduated in 75.
So was that good or grimacing when you would read I Am Curious Black, or you would see Little Harlem in Metropolis or Little Africa in Metropolis?
It was just funny, bro. Come on, Little Africa. Give me a freaking break. Okay. Lois Lane turns black for 24 hours. And I should do it. 24 hours is long enough. And how fortunate for her. Her boyfriend, who happens to be Superman, can change her from white to black. And the interesting thing was that wasn't the only place that story was taking place. I have a copy of True Confessions magazine from that same era. And on the front, they have a white woman, blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, attractive. And she says, I turned black. And that's another picture where who would be fooled that you were a black person? They just darkened your skin and put a wig on their head. I said, you know what? That's just funny. You know, and it's just like trading on stereotypes of black people, of course, have been speaking very stereotypical language and they wouldn't talk to her. They did, like they didn't talk to Lois Lane. But once they think she's black, and so everything is cool. So that just makes you ignorant, you know. But I also appreciate because we go through stages. We go through tokenism. We go patriotism. You know, we try different images. And the freedom to try that, I think, is where we should be. Anybody, just look at what they did for women. I mean, women were, how many years? Sue Storm, when she first started, she was like just cute and posing and you know, and let's face it, kind of dumb. As time goes on, she's become like the leader more than one time. You know.
Oh, yeah. By those early days, the Thing would take her over his knee and spank her. You know, I mean, they're
right.
They're horrible. Well,
yeah, I mean, I think because Stan and Jack were kind of doing romance comic stuff in that Fantastic Four.
And also they, that reminded me, so, Marvel Girl, when she first, joined the X-Men, it was the same thing. And somebody just made me realize that in one of his thought balloons, Professor Xavier saying he's in love with her.
I remember that. Yeah,
yeah, that's creepy.
That confused me many years later. I was like, what?
Creepy. And not just a little bit. whoa, Professor. Whoa.
Now, Marvel's got like a bunch of those creepy things, whether it's Clea sleeping with Ben Franklin or it's the Ms. Marvel thought rape.
Yeah. That's kind of the freedom. They had a little more freedom to do whatever. Yeah.
When you first introduce the characters, you're trying to figure out what's going to work out, But yeah, no, I had a kind of a clear sense of what's important and what's not, because I was working on those same issues, that someone doesn't look like me. Does that mean that they deserve to be treated less than me? Well, I have been treated less than, and I didn't like it. So I'm not going to do the same thing as somebody else. I got to do better.
Yeah.
And when the comic book showed that was great.
So, and then I'm going to turn it over to Alex, but at some point did you decide, nobody's written about African-American comic characters in the way that they should, because we interviewed Trina Robbins a couple of times and
fan of hers.
And Trina said nobody was writing about the subject. And so it wasn't that she set out to be a writer, but she said nobody else was doing it. So I had to. Did you feel that way?
Yeah, I had to kind of bring attention to it because no one else was. The best thing about where I am right now, where I sit right now in comics, is that I have been able to find all kinds of writers, people who have gone off into obscurity and I pulled them back. Young people I see at shows, I immediately go to the table. This is who I am. Please send me copies of your work. So I'm become the lodestone, and that's a role that doesn't upset me at all. But back in the day, not so much, my brother. Yeah. Really not.
I had an epiphany of, wow, there's a whole nother side to comic history. I had that with Trina's Women in Comics book, but I had that same with yours on Looking for a Face Like Mine. No one else was looking at it in that way. And what I want to do for the audience and us to talk about it, and this is your area of specialty, you've run museum exhibits on this, you've been in a couple of documentaries, Superheroes: A Neverending Battle, and then comic book Superheroes Unmasked, both nationally aired. So you've been on TV talking about this stuff. This particular area is a specialty of yours. Let's go through kind of a timeline of starting with the Yellow Kid and moving to the present a little bit. There's quite a bit there, but so you had mentioned, I'd watched, one of your interviews, and then I also read your book as well. The Yellow Kid, 1895, Hogan's Alley. Now, a lot of the early comic strips, like the 1890s I'm talking about, before everything was nationally syndicated and homogenized and kind of whitewashed in a way, in the 1890s, they were showing like local New York life in The Yellow Kid. And you were mentioning that there was like a gang of kids and The Yellow Kid was one of them. There's some African-American kids. Tell us about that scenery and then move us forward through time, like with Crazy Cat and stuff like that.
Oh, no problem, brother. Crazy Cat, how much time you got? The Yellow Kid, basically, if you look at the neighborhood photographs, it's like, and you can't tell somebody's Irish by looking at him unless he's got one of those little white pipes in his mouth, But then, or the Jewish kid has a yarmulke, and the black kid's obviously a little more obvious when you can tell. Sometimes you couldn't even tell if the girls were girls because they would be wearing pants like the boys. But it was sort of like the our gang kind of theory. The idea is that these are just kids and they're coming from different places, and they're speaking differently, but they're getting along. Now, the adults can't do it, but the kids can do it. In fact, our gang did that many times as a theme. It's kind of an American theme. And you're right, because in the city, and that's, I used to kid with my students in my communication class about that, is that if you're living next door to somebody, you live in one, two apartment next to somebody, you know exactly what's going on there. When there's a funeral, there's a wedding, there was an argument, the walls were paper thin. And either you understood that everybody was the same. Oh, those blah, 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 they always fight. Dad, you were doing the same thing last night. So you get a chance to have a sense of how our experiences are pretty much the same. We're going through the same thing. Nobody was really rich, but then nobody was really poor. And if you ask me, I'd tell you my family wasn't poor, but if you look at compared to somebody else or contrast somebody else, that was true. So they started with that. Now you move into the 1920s, 1930s. and comic books are taking on a place of their own. I think I mentioned that when everybody was in bootlegging and making all kinds of illegal money, didn't have any place to show when the IRS came by, suddenly comic books became a place where they could hide those profits.
Okay.
No one says that about DC. No one says about, you know, that's kind of what took place, that suddenly they had all this cash. In fact, can you guys see this? I don't know.
Yeah, Best Comics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know that character. Yes.
The Red Mask. First black hero in a comic book. You know,
yes.
A year before Negro, you know, all Negro comics came out.
Yes.
No one knows who wrote it. No one knows who drew it. And when the people found out that he was the black superhero, they tried to put out another one where he turned white. And that just off the face of the earth.
Yeah, I noticed that the coloring was inconsistent after a couple issues. I'm like, what is this? Now, George Harriman, there is some discussion in his lineage that there he had some African-American heritage. And he did stuff also besides Crazy Cat, like before Crazy Cat kind of became his thing. But there's one, I think it was called Musical Moe's or something like that, where...
Little Moe's?
Yeah, and it was about a black character that was trying to pass himself as white in a white society, and there were some physical bloopers that happened. Do you feel he was expressing something? And what's your take on that form of comedy back then?
Well, here's an interesting thing. Harriman came out of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I think we are near New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And of all the places in this country, that's places where race mixing was taking place on a regular level. But if you were white, it didn't matter what you were. So when people say, well, he was trying to act like he wasn't black, he supposedly kept his hair cut short and he always wore a hat. But then you have people who say, well, you're crazy. He took it off whenever he felt like it. You know, he wasn't a dark-skinned guy. But it talks about the kind of, what's the word I want? The kind of sickness about race that we have in this country, about you can't be too dark or people passing. I have to explain to my students what passing is. They have no idea. Now, they've seen it, but they didn't know it was called that. Okay. I had to explain to them what the paper bag test was. They didn't know what that was either. And Louisiana, believe me, that went on all the time. Some of my favorite novels are about what those days used to be, you know, be like. I loved Crazy Cat. Of course, my introduction to it was when I was a young kid, the animated Crazy Cat was made by the same people who made Popeye. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, you move from one to the other. But no, I don't feel anything like, you know, like any kind of skullduggery was going on that he was trying to hide who he was. And this, I think his kids said the same thing, you know. And the South, well, I don't even want to put it on the South. In America, if you're having kids and suddenly one of the kids is real dark, now it's a couple of things that could have happened. But what do people think of the first thing? They think of the worst possible scenario, you know. And men never got blamed. Women always got blamed.
Mm.
And that's kind of like the legacy of slavery and racism, you know, and as well as, you know, against women. So I think it's just kind of people who just got kind of caught up with that. I don't know if anybody ever took it seriously, and I don't know if he ever lost any jobs. He was just too damn good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Did you know when you first heard his name, when you first saw pages of Crazy Cat, did you know at that time that he was black or mixed race? Or is that something you found out later?
I said something that people were discussing later. Like I said, I go to the Popular Culture Association conferences, and there was always somebody doing an extreme, long, and not necessarily interesting paper on that as the major theme. And I'm like, and I guess that's an interesting point. But in the end, I had to make the same decision I made about Superman and Batman. Love their books. Just noticed that there were no black people there. That doesn't mean that I didn't love their books.
Right. That's cool.
Once you found out, did you read Crazy Cat, the characters as black?
No, but I did read to see if maybe I had missed something, because I allowed for that possibility that maybe something was being said or something he was saying some message. But no, I didn't. And I've read some stuff where the subtext was a lot less, you know, subtle, and I said, whoa. Somebody here has a problem. One of my students wrote a book. He wrote his own comic book. And the title of the book is called Wigger, effectively White Nigger.
Yeah.
And I thought it was brilliant, because first of all, nobody around them would even say that word because they're so afraid of being, you know, brush with a tar brush, but he was a good writer. He told the story very well. He said he gets tired of being the white guy all surrounded by black guys, but he thinks they're really cool. So the only people that complained, he said, were white people or black people who didn't know him. His buddies mm-hmm. would just look at him and laugh, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't, you know. So the idea is that how we get along, which is that ultimate message about what we read and what we promote, is it's got to be the most important thing a story is telling us. Now, nowadays, you can be as nihilistic as you want to be in the telling of a comic book story or a graphic novel story. But I was raised in the age where if we're not saying something that's going to promote us, then what are we doing? You know, I understand that the apocalyptic, you know, is interesting reading, but in the end, maybe there's ought to be some stories that kind of balance that all. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And that's what I'm looking for, is a balance.
Yeah, I like you have a positive attitude about a lot of this stuff.
I'm curious on one thing, though, and go back to Please. Alex. But in terms of, you look at Crazy Cat and sure. you look at Little Nemo, and they're both the two masterworks of that era, let's say. And do you hit a point where you say, I like Little Nemo, but it's hard to get past the racist aspect of it, the African kid that's along with it, that's got the bone in the nose, or, you know, certainly looks like that.
And in the 90s cartoon, they replaced him with a squirrel or something like that.
Squirrels are
it's
good.
Funny. It's interesting. I think one of the reasons I read a bunch of old cartoon strips is because I was interested in what lifestyle was like back in that period of time. My parents talked about it. My grandparents talked about it. I didn't know anything about it. But the race thing, yeah, you kind of notice that. Who are the major characters? And when you show a black character, what do you show them as? You show them as speaking slow and pidgin English and, you know, not being clever, you know. But then I did a piece for Hogan's Alley magazine where I talked about Henry, the kid who never talked. Never had a mouth, never had a, you know, never had a conversation balloon. And in a surprising number of his strips, he's got black friends, you know, or black kids in the neighborhood. In fact, he even one place where he sees a black man with four kids going into the ice cream parlor. Henry stops next door to the shoeshine parlor, comes back out. He's a black kid. He used shoe polish orders because he wanted free ice cream.
Oh, now, see, that's interesting.
Yeah. So now here's one that I don't know if anybody ever mentioned, Little Lulu. When she was appearing in ads in Saturday Evening Post, a lot of anti-black in Little Lulu. Never got to, only once or twice in her animated cartoons did you get a chance to see it. But I was stunned by that. You know, Saturday Evening Post, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
What the heck?
So let's talk a little bit about Jackie Orms, 1937, going to 1940, and then there's a later run, the Torchy Brown strip. So that's just kind of amazing that we have a female African-American cartoonist doing in newspaper comic strips, and they're syndicated, is it mainly by black newspapers? Is that what was going on?
Yeah,
and
that's exactly
and,
right.
And we're, how amazing is it because that she was doing this in 1937?
It's, yeah, I'm telling you, it was an interesting period of time, and she was like very prolific in that, you know, and how she portrayed the character, an environmentalist, a nurse, you know, went back down south, mm-hmm. you know, and came back, you know, like, and I can tell you for my family, when they left the south, there was nothing going to get them back, you know, mm-hmm. but she had an appreciation. There was a call and a calling, and that's what she did. So she was a character much to be, you know, to be admired. And Jackie Orms as a female cartoonist, you're right, dude, that was just like amazing.
Yeah, she just had the artistic storytelling drive, which is amazing that happened. Let's talk a little bit about Will Eisner's Ebony character. You put him into five categories of black representation in films. You apply that to comics as well. Mm-hmm. Ebony represents one of these five categories that you had laid out in your book.
Sure.
There is also a 1973 conversation with Ebony White by Will Eisner that you applauded in your book as well, that you applauded it. What's your take on the Ebony character, the movement that some of the younger people are saying that we should get his name removed off of the Comic Industry Awards, that, you know, what's your take on Ebony? What was your impression of his 1973 conversation? Tell us about that.
I tell you what, I'll start off with my conversation with Will Eisner. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I got lucky enough to do this, but one San Diego Con, and he was always swamped. And so I decided I'll come back later. And I came back, and like literally there was nobody, it had to be lunchtime. Nobody was around his booth. So I said, Mr. Eisner, I'm a big fan of your work. And I talked to him about, I said, what do you think about how people felt about Ebony? And he kind of paused for a second, because it's obviously the first time he's been asked. And he said, well, it depends on when you ask me. He said, sometimes people have said that it was a great idea to be inclusive. And other people said, how dare you have such a despicable image of us? And he said he got awards from NAACP at one point. And he said, at another point, you know, they completely condemned him. And he had, now it's interesting to me, he also had a black police officer who was in more than one strip and more than one comic. And they have one where Ebony, because the black girl turns him down, decides he's going to go back to school to get rid of his Southern accent. He said he doesn't want to be recognized as a minstrel. Mm-hmm. You have black soldiers. So it's, you know, if I was doing characters, I would be real careful about who I painted. But at the same token, I don't know if you guys remember the creator of Dennis the Menace.
Mm-hmm. Hank Ketchum.
Hank Ketchum, yeah.
Yep. Hank Ketchum came out with a black character about a year, maybe two, after Charles Schulz introduced
Franklin,
the black character, Franklin. And he did not get the same reaction as Charles Schulz got. People came after him with almost guns and knives. He was in Europe at the time, and he got a wire saying, get back over here. They're crashing in the offices, you know, they're, you know, destroying property. And his goal, he said, his response was this. He said, wait a minute. Every cartoon character is a caricature of somebody. Find somebody who looks like Mr. Wilson with his big ass, or, you know, and has a, or Dennis's father who has a nose like a nose cone. Okay. Or Dennis himself who looks like a tramp with a load in his pants. You know, that's what I'm doing. You know, you're creating something, but the idea is that people were, as we said, I can't make anybody less sensitive than they are when they see an image that they think is really negative. So Ebony, and I didn't feel insulted because on top of everything else, now, I got a question for you guys. I used to do it for my students. You remember the old TV show, I Spy?
Yeah.
Robert Cole, Bill Cosby. Okay, here we go. I want you to think about a typical episode. They're getting into a car. Who's driving? Is it Cosby or is it Culp? If it's Cosby, is he the servant? If it's Culp, it's because he's the master. Or does it not make a difference?
Right. Yeah. Sometimes people will get their own impression of something.
And so I think that's the same thing. We're going to see it continuously until somebody comes out with a character that's just so stereotypical that they're just going to, and it'll be done for that point. Okay. Because there's got to be artistic freedom on one side and you got to be telling a story on the other side. And mm-hmm. And we all think that every point has to be, you know, you have to hit these numbers on every story you do. When has that ever been true? Because that's been changing dramatically. Think about a character like Spawn, who was a black guy when he was alive, but now the skin's burned off. But people still think of him as a black superhero. I have a friend who says, no, I don't want no dead guy as a superhero.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, and it's such a yin and yang. But for me, when was the last time I was offended by a character? Oh, okay. I collect all kinds of comic books. So I collected one that was put out by the American Nazi Party. And so you can have an appreciation what kind of characters they showed on.
Yeah.
That just, I just screamed, you know, you weren't trying to be nice to nobody. You're trying to make a real important statement about what you think about other races and other religions. Okay. And the more cruel and violent you were to those members of those races or those religions, the more you thought you were making your point. Gotcha. Not lost at all.
But you don't really have to go all the way back to the Nazis to be offended by. I mean, like, there's American comics that I'm sure. You know,
They never had an important role. They were only shown for surface, you know, protection, like on the cover, never seen inside the book. There weren't any black superheroes. There were no black superheroines. And yeah, so the absence and then the people who did appear, were they something to be admired? Nope, not for the longest time.
Yeah. Noticed you have kind of two perspectives kind of happening at the same time.
Sure.
And they're valid and they're both true. Is there's that one aspect of we should be represented better. But then there's another aspect of, and you said this in your book, that it's better than nothing, and that I love the comics for its form, and I love the history of it, and that you appreciate it for where it was. It's kind of interesting that you have both of those happening at the same time.
World's a big place. Got it. And what's one of the biggest problems we have right this minute, this time in history, is that if you don't think the exact same way I do, not only must you be punished, but you must be punished severely.
Yeah.
I think that's horrible. But here's the thing. I've seen enough. I've seen enough of people of color creating their own comic books. And that's the excitement for me. And it never ends. And then I've seen them move into mainstream comics and do their own books. So with the point where you had nothing on the screen to the point now you have any number of points of view. And that's the only way it can be. No one black person can represent the entire race. No one woman can represent the entire gender. And yet somebody will always say, well, we got one. No, that's called tokenism. And that's not a good idea.
Yeah, right. True. Now, and talking about African-Americans making their own comics. So as a segue into it, you mentioned, this is kind of interesting. I like kind of throwing these in, but in 1945, World's Finest Comics 17, there was actually a tribute to African-Americans serving in World War II called Johnny Everyman. That was pretty cool. And then a couple years after that, you had mentioned it earlier, All Negro Comics. And what was interesting was you put it, it was by Orrin Evans.
Yep.
And you had an excitement in the way you wrote about it, in that African-Americans having control over their own imagery, and that you had mentioned that that was something that was especially meaningful. Tell us about the significance of All Negro Comics.
Orrin Evans was a reporter, and he was more than just a reporter. He was actually the guy who created the Negro, journalism organization. But and so he was not afraid to get into a cop's face, which is, even at that point in time would have been horrendously dangerous. But he said, is either going to be straight or it ain't going to be. He said he got tired of seeing comic strips that didn't have people like him. So when the paper he was working for went out of business, I'm reasonably certain all the guys he got weren't all black, but he got a bunch of guys who he knew could do the job, and they put out their book. He was so impressed that he could sell this book, he sold it for 15 cents when every other comic book was selling for 12,
mm-hmm.
which was a major thing to do. And full color, he did the book, not only the cover, but the inside.
Right.
And he did a great African king. He did a black detective. He did black fairies. You know, he just went, he took the stories wherever he could. And I thought that was amazing. It only lasted one issue, which I happen to have one copy of, because I happen to be in the right place at the right time. That's how it gets done. And then you get other people deciding that maybe we ought to try this. So you get Negro Heroes. Who was that, Dell? Or was that, I think it was Dell. And then you have a 1965.
Yeah, Lobo.
Yep. First comic book that features a black character as a main character. Now, I met both the guys who put that book together.
Oh, yeah? Oh, that's cool.
Got lucky. I happened to be doing an exhibit on Long Island, and this guy walks up and he said, hey, that's my work. I said, I thought you guys were dead. And then I met the other one because I did a comic book show while I was teaching at my college, and the guy shows up. He lived not far from where we were doing it. And I couldn't believe it. I had him come down to there's a big black comic book convention after Philadelphia every May. I had him come down. They gave him a Founders Award. You know, he's a white guy, but he was the guy who said he read a book called The Black Cowboys, and he said, we need to do something.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's a real thing in history that it should be told. That story needs to be told.
And there were black Westerns all the time. I mean, there was a whole, that was very common, African-American Westerns during the serial period.
But sadly, they were only shown in black theaters and only one night a week.
Yeah.
It was like specialty films. And it took me years to figure this out because at the time I was going to theater, you go anywhere, you know. But to be only allowed to go on the Crow's Nest and only on certain days of the week and only, you know, and they would cut certain scenes out of movies so that it didn't look like black folks and white folks were getting along, you know. I was like, geez, you know, people before me had to go through a lot of jobs.
Yeah, that's right.
And I never understood that, you know, because it wasn't my experience, you know. It's like riding on the back of the bus. If I can put that point in, is that when I was a kid, back in the bus was where the fun was.
Right.
You know, it wasn't, that's where somebody was playing cards or somebody had a guitar or somebody was passing around a bottle or something, you know. But before us, that was never like that. And you need somebody to kind of give you a sense of that history.
Before we jump too deep into the 60s, because 60s and 70s are their own pretty amazing story in this. But in the 50s, there are a couple of notes. One, you mentioned Batman 57, Batman and Robin, a stand up for sportsmanship, probably Jack Smith's statement that racial fighting weakens our country. So that was an interesting thing. It's cool that you found all these and that you put them in your book like that. Then you also mentioned, and Jim will find this one interesting, is 1964-ish, you have the war comics. And you have, you know, Our Army at War, Star Spangled War Stories, Sergeant Fury, Howling Commandos. And it's, and you had mentioned, and you had mentioned in the book when it came out that you weren't sure why, but war stories tend to be a fertile ground for a racial discussion. Why is that? First, what's your impression? And then maybe Jim can weigh in on what he thinks it is too.
Oh, no problem. The particular story I read when it was like real early in the run of Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos, they had a guy who joined their commando unit, and they had an Englishman, they had an Italian-American, they had a Jewish guy, they had a black guy, they had a Southern guy, you know, and then you had Sergeant Fury, who was from New York, or from Hell's Kitchen. And this guy, when they bring him into the barracks, I'm not, you know, and they say, well, here, you'll be sleeping next to this guy. I'm not sleeping next to a black guy. Get that Jewish guy out of here. It's like, and they call him on it. They say, you're a bigot. We work as a team, and we all die, you know. And sure enough, this guy, because he wants to be a hero, and he's like starting to fight when they're right in front of the Germans, and it looks like you're all going to get killed. And he gets the message, but he doesn't. It's not so obvious. Oh, gee, fellas, that's great. It's a small world, you know. That's not what happened. The idea is that he gets it, but he can't admit it to them. That I liked about the story. Now, on the other side of that, in terms of realistic, there was never an integrated unit in the United States Army, ever. Yeah. Least of all the commandos, you know. But despite that, I loved the fiction. I ate it up, you know. They had all separate skills. They, you know, they worked together. They looked out for each other. Hey, come on, who wouldn't be a part of that gang?
Yeah, that's true. Jim, what's your take on the war genre and racial discussion?
Well, I think in comics it was really clear. I mean, because, you know, I think of Blackhawks and Chop Chop and how, and so many, or Young Allies, where Kirby does it, horrible black kid. Whereas when they bring in Sergeant Fury, Gabe is as competent as anybody and one of the cooler characters. It's a little silly with the trumpet. But it's okay. Later, they use him in terms of music and that story that takes place in France and the treatment of black men. That's kind of brilliant. They're good on that. The story that the professor's talking about, doesn't that end with Gabe actually giving blood to the racist? You know, so it's a little heavy-handed in terms of the last comments, the final panel, but it's good. And I think in film, you don't get a lot of that until probably after Fury and Rock and those stories are, I think comics really are leading the charge, so to speak.
Well, I think it's also that when you guys were talking about Marvel earlier, that they felt they could do it. DC, maybe not so much.
Right.
And that Marvel ran with it, that they could make a change about something. It wasn't like they were, you know, all of a sudden Sergeant Fury is like black one day, you know, but the idea that he encourages his men to have an appreciation for each other, you know, and I don't know if DC was at that point in time, don't know, was open to that kind of storytelling.
But none of it compares to that EC story where the white guy goes and is being celebrated and he finds out that his fellow black soldier is buried somewhere else and is not honored. And he calls them all out on race. That's one of the, I mean, that's ahead of its time like nothing else
is. I love that story. I loved it because you had to read it carefully and you had to keep up where he was going with the story.
Speaking of EC, did you like, you know, that Judgment Day story where the astronaut, this is 1953 now, we're going to go back to the 60s right after that, but The astronaut talks about it's at the robot planet, and there's one color robot versus another, and there is this kind of bigotry going on. And then the astronaut says, "You guys aren't quite ready yet," and he takes off his helmet. He's an African American man, and then there is some weird thing with Bill Gaines and the comics code saying, "Well, you can't have sweaty beads on an African American's head. It's too sexual." And they gave him all this.
God.
They gave him all this hell, and they wouldn't distribute the comic over it, or not. They wouldn't distribute, but the comics code wouldn't approve it, so the newsstands would distribute it until he complained enough. But what's your take on that story? And is that still a powerful story?
That reminded me, or maybe it was probably, I couldn't tell who inspired each, but I'm guessing that they later inspired the Twilight Zone for the same thing, where Rod Serling told stories about, you know, racial inequity all the damn time, you know,
yeah.
And must have made the censors crazy. But yeah, the idea that it's like you don't want to tell the story, but you got to tell the story. Mm-hmm. No one says, you know, well, we're not prejudiced, but we're not talking about it. Then you're prejudiced. Shut up. Okay. And that, you know, they just couldn't get it. So I love that story. And it's like, it's surprising to me how well known that story has become, you know?
Yeah.
I had a friend, I just sent a copy of the comments page in the next issue where people wrote letters about what they thought of the story. And it was interesting that it was kind of an even mix in terms of what people thought they liked and what they didn't like. And one guy says, well, if you like niggas so much, why don't you go live with them? Oh, how did you find a pen? And somebody else said, thank you. Thank you for telling the story like you told it. So it's, you know, they took the chance. If they hadn't, you know, now nobody would have said anything, but I think the world would have been poorer for not having heard it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you, Professor Foster, for going over the history of African-American portrayal in comic books. Stay tuned next week for part two of the Professor Foster interview here at the Comic Book Historians Podcast with Alex Grand and Jim Thompson.